past him and runs his hand over my hair, tucking it behind my ear. His fingers trail down my neck and over my shoulder, and he says, "But you will do it. It doesn't matter if you believe you can or not. You will, because that's who you are." I pull back and fit my mouth to his, not gently, not hesitantly. I kiss him like I used to, when I felt sure of us, and run my hands over his back, down his arms like I used to. I don't want to tell him the truth, that he is wrong, and I do not want to survive this. The door opens. Dauntless traders crowd into the supply closet. Tobias steps back, turns the gun in his hand, and offers it, handle first, to the nearest dauntless trader. Chapter 33. Beatrice. I jerk awake. The room I am in now, for whatever experiment they want to run on me, is large, with screens along the back wall, and blue lights glowing just above the floor and rows of padded benches across the middle. I'm sitting on the farthest bench back with Peter at my left shoulder, my head leaning against the wall. I still can't seem to get enough sleep. Now I wish I hadn't woken up. Caleb stands a few feet away, his weight on one foot, an uncertain posture. "Did you ever leave Erudite?" I say. "It's not that simple," he starts. It is that simple. I want to yell, but instead my voice comes out flat. "At what point did you betray our family? Before our parents died, or after?" "I did what I had to do. You think you understand this, Beatrice, but you don't. This whole situation, it's much bigger than you think it is." His eyes plead with me to understand, but I recognize his tone. It's the one he employed when we were younger, to scold me. It is condescending. Arrogance is one of the flaws in the erudite heart. I know. It is often in mine. But greed is the other. And I do not have that. So I'm halfway in and halfway out, as always. I push myself to my feet. "You still haven't answered my question." Caleb steps back. "This isn't about erudite. It's about everyone. All the factions," he says. "And the city. And what's outside the fence." "I don't care," I say. But that isn't true. The phrase, "outside the fence," prickles in my brain. Outside? How could any of this have to do with what's outside? Something itches at the back of my mind. Marcus said that information the abnegation possessed motivated Janine's attack on abnegation. Does that information have to do with what's outside, too? I push the thought away for the time being. "I thought you were all about facts. About freedom of information. Well, how about this fact, Caleb? When..." My voice quakes. "When did you betray our parents?" "I have always been erudite," he says softly. "Even when I was supposed to be abnegation." "If you're with Janine, then I hate you. Just like our father would have." "Our father?" Caleb snorts a little. "Our father was erudite, Beatrice. Janine told me. He was in her year at school." "He wasn't erudite," I say after a few seconds. "He chose to leave them. He chose a different identity, just like you, and became something else. Only you chose this. This evil." "Spoken like a true dauntless," says Caleb sharply. "It's either one way or the other. No nuances. The world doesn't work like that, Beatrice. Evil depends on where you're standing." "No matter where I stand, I'll still think mind-controlling an entire city of people is evil." I feel my lip wobble. "I'll still think delivering your sister to be prodded and executed is evil." He is my brother, but I want to tear him to pieces. Instead of trying to, though, I find myself sitting down again. I could never hurt him enough to make his betrayal stop hurting. And it hurts. In every part of my body. I press my fingers to my chest to massage some of the smarting tension away. Janine and her army of erudite scientists and dauntless traders walk in, just as I wipe tears from my cheeks. I blink rapidly so she won't see. She barely even gives me a glance. "Let us view the results, shall we?" she announces. Caleb, now standing by the screens, presses something at the front of the room, and the screens turn on. Words and numbers I don't understand fill them.
"We discovered something extremely interesting, Miss Pryor."
I have never seen her so cheerful before. She almost smiles, but not quite. "You have an abundance of a particular kind of neuron, called, quite simply, a mirror neuron. Would someone like to explain to Miss Pryor exactly what mirror neurons do?" The erudite scientists raise their hands in unison. She points to an older woman in the front. "Mirror neurons fire both when one performs an action and when one sees another person performing that action. They allow us to imitate behavior."
"What else are they responsible for?"
Janine scans her class, the same way my teachers did in upper levels. Another erudite raises his hand. "Learning language, understanding other people's intentions based on their behavior, he frowns, and empathy." "More specifically," Janine says, and this time she does smile at me, broadly, forcing creases into her cheeks. "Someone with many strong mirror neurons could have a flexible personality, capable of mimicking others as the situation calls for it, rather than remaining constant." I understand why she smiles. I feel like my mind is cracked open, its secrets spilling over the floor for me to finally see.
"A flexible personality," she says, "would probably have aptitude for more than one faction. Don't you agree, Miss Pryor?"
"Probably," I say. "Now, if only you could get a simulation to suppress that particular ability, we could be done with this."
"One thing at a time." She pauses.
"I must admit, it confuses me that you are so eager for your own execution." "No, it doesn't." I close my eyes. "It doesn't confuse you at all," I sigh. "Can I go back to my cell now?" I must seem nonchalant, but I'm not. I want to go back to my room so that I can cry in peace, but I don't want her to know that.
"Don't get too comfortable," she chirps.
"We'll have a simulation serum to try out soon." "Yeah," I say. "Whatever." Someone shakes my shoulder. I jerk awake, my eyes wide and searching, and I see Tobias kneeling over me. He wears a dauntless trader jacket, and one side of his head is coated with blood. The blood streams from a wound on his ear. The top of his ear is gone. I wince.
"What happened?" I say.
"Get up. We have to run."
"It's too soon. It hasn't been 2 weeks."
"I don't have time to explain. Come on."
"Oh, God. Tobias."
I sit up and wrap my arms around him, pressing my face into his neck. His arms tighten around me and squeeze. Warmth courses through me, and comfort. If he is here, that means I'm safe. My tears make his skin slippery. He stands and pulls me to my feet, which makes my wounded shoulder throb.
"Reinforcements will be here soon. Come on."
I let him lead me out of the room. We make it down the first hallway without difficulty, but in the second hallway, we encounter two dauntless guards, one a young man and one a middle-aged woman. Tobias fires twice in a matter of seconds. Both hits, one in the head and one in the chest. The woman who was hit in the chest slumps against the wall, but doesn't die. We keep moving. One hallway, then another. All of them look the same. Tobias's grip on my hand never falters. I know that if he can throw a knife so that it hits just the tip of my ear, he can fire accurately at the dauntless soldiers who ambush us. We step over fallen bodies. The people Tobias killed on the way in, probably, and finally reach a fire exit.
Tobias lets go of my hand to open the door, and the fire alarm screeches in my ears. But we keep running. I'm gasping for air, but I don't care. Not when I'm finally escaping. Not when this nightmare is finally over. My vision starts to go black at the edges, so I grab Tobias's arm and hold on tight, trusting him to lead me safely to the bottom of the stairs. I run out of steps to run down, and I open my eyes. Tobias is about to open the exit door, but I hold him back.
Got to catch my breath.
He pauses, and I put my hands on my knees, leaning over. My shoulder still throbs. I frown and look up at him.
Come on, let's get out of here,
he says insistently. My stomach sinks. I stare into his eyes. They are dark blue, with a patch of light blue on his right iris. I take his chin in hand and pull his lips down to mine, kissing him slowly, sighing as I pull back.
We can't get out of here, I say, because this is a simulation.
He pulled me to my feet with my right hand. The real Tobias would have remembered the wound in my shoulder.
What?
He scowls at me. Don't you think I would know if I was under a simulation?
You aren't under a simulation. You are the simulation.
I look up and say in a loud voice, You'll have to do better than that, Janine. All I have to do now is wake up. And I know how. I have done it before. In my fear landscape. When I broke a glass tank just by touching my palm to it. Or when I made a gun appear in the grass to shoot descending birds. I take a knife from my pocket. A knife that wasn't there a moment ago. And will my leg to be hard as diamond. I thrust the knife toward my thigh. And the blade bends. I wake up with tears in my eyes. I wake to Janine's scream of frustration.
What is it?
She grabs Peter's gun out of his hand and stalks across the room, pressing the barrel to my forehead. My body stiffens, goes cold. She won't shoot me. I am a problem she can't solve. She won't shoot me.
What is it that clues you in? Tell me. Tell me or I will kill you.
I slowly push myself up from the chair, coming to my feet, pushing my skin harder into the cold barrel.
You think I'm going to tell you? I say. You think I believe that you would kill me without figuring out the answer to this question? You stupid girl, she says. You think this is about you and your abnormal brain? This is not about you. It is not about me. It is about keeping the city safe from the people who intend to plunge it into hell.
I summon the last of my strength and launch myself at her, clawing at whatever skin my fingernails find, digging in as hard as I can. She screams at the top of her lungs, a sound that turns my blood into fire. I punch her hard in the face. A pair of arms wrap around me, pulling me off her, and a fist meets my side. I groan and lunge toward her, held at bay by Peter.
Pain can't make me tell you. Truth serum can't make me tell you. Simulations can't make me tell you. I'm immune to all three.
Her nose is bleeding, and I see lines of fingernail scrapes in her cheeks, on the side of her throat, turning red with blossoming blood. She glares at me, pinching her nose closed, her hair disheveled. Her free hand trembling.
You have failed. You can't control me!
I scream, so loud it hurts my throat. I stop struggling and sag against Peter's chest.
You will never be able to control me.
I laugh, mirthless, a mad laugh. I savor the scowl on her face, the hate in her eyes.
She was like a machine.
She was cold and emotionless, bound by logic alone. And I broke her. I broke her. Chapter 34. Once I'm in the hallway, I stop struggling toward Janine. My side throbs from where Peter punched me, but it's nothing compared to the pulse of triumph in my cheeks. Peter walks me back to my cell without a word. I stand in the middle of the room for a long time, staring at the camera in the back left corner. Who is watching me all the time? Is it Dauntless Traders guarding me, or the erudite observing me? Once the heat leaves my face and my side stops hurting, I lie down. A picture of my parents floats into my head the moment I close my eyes. Once, when I was about 11, I stopped at the doorway to my parents' bedroom to watch them make the bed together. My father smiled at my mother as they pulled the sheets back and smoothed them down in perfect synchronicity. I knew by the way he looked at her that he held her in a higher regard than he held even himself. No selfishness or insecurity kept him from seeing the full extent of her goodness, as it so often does with the rest of us. That kind of love might only be possible in abnegation. I do not know. My father, erudite born, abnegation grown. He often found it difficult to live up to the demands of his chosen faction, just as I did. But he tried, and he knew true selflessness when he saw it. I clutch my pillow to my chest and bury my face in it. I don't cry. I just ache. Grief is not as heavy as guilt, but it takes more away from you. Stiff! I wake with a start, my hands still clutching the pillow. There is a wet patch on the mattress under my face. I sit up, wiping my eyes with my fingertips. Peter's eyebrows, which usually turn up in the middle, are furrowed. What happened? Whatever it is, it can't be good. Your execution has been scheduled for tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. My execution? But she hasn't developed the right simulation yet. She couldn't possibly...
She said that she will continue the experiments on Tobias instead of you, he says.
All I can say is, oh. I clutch the mattress and rock forward and back, forward and back. Tomorrow my life will be over. Tobias may survive long enough to escape in the factionless invasion. The Dauntless will elect a new leader. All the loose ends I will leave will be easily tied up. I nod. No family left. No loose ends. No great loss. I could have forgiven you, you know, I say, for trying to kill me during initiation. I probably could have. We are both quiet for a while. I don't know why I told him that. Maybe just because it's true. And tonight, of all nights, is the time for honesty. Tonight I will be honest, and selfless, and brave. Divergent. I never asked you to, he says and turns to leave. But then, he stops at the doorframe and says, It's 9:24. Telling me the time is a small act of betrayal, and therefore, an ordinary act of bravery. It is maybe the first time I've ever seen Peter be truly dauntless. I'm going to die tomorrow. It has been a long time since I felt certainty about anything. So this feels like a gift. Tonight, nothing. Tomorrow, whatever comes after life. And Janine still doesn't know how to control the divergent. When I start to cry, I clutch the pillow to my chest and let it happen. I cry hard, like a child cries, until my face is hot, and I feel like I might be sick. I can pretend to be brave, but I'm not. I suppose that now would be the time to ask for forgiveness for all the things I've done. But I'm sure my list would never be complete. I also don't believe that whatever comes after life depends on my correctly reciting a list of my transgressions. That sounds too much like an erudite afterlife to me. All accuracy and no feeling. I don't believe that what comes after depends on anything I do at all. I am better off doing as abnegation taught me, turning away from myself, projecting always outward, and hoping that in whatever is next, I will be better than I am now.
I smile a little. I wish I could tell my parents that I will die like the abnegation. They would be proud, I think. Chapter 35. This morning I put on the clean clothes I am given. Black pants, too loose, but who cares? And a long-sleeved black shirt. No shoes. It is not time yet. I find myself lacing my fingers together and bowing my head. Sometimes my father did this in the morning before sitting down at the breakfast table, but I never asked him what he was doing. Still, I would like to feel like I belong to my father again before I... well, before it's over. A few silent moments later, Peter tells me it's time to go. He barely looks at me, scowls at the back wall instead. I suppose it would have been too much to ask to see a friendly face this morning. I stand and together we walk down the hallway. My toes are cold. My feet stick to the tiles. We turn a corner and I hear muffled shouts. At first I can't tell what the voice is saying, but as we draw closer it takes shape. I want to... her. Tobias. I... see her. I glance at Peter. I can't speak to him one last time, can I? Peter shakes his head. There's a window, though. Maybe if he sees you, he'll finally shut up. He takes me down a dead-end corridor that's only 6 feet long. At the end is a door, and Peter is right. There's a small window near the top, about a foot above my head. Triss! Tobias's voice is even clearer here. I want to see her! I reach up and press my palm to the glass. The shouts stop, and his face appears behind the glass. His eyes are red, his face blotchy. Handsome. He stares down at me for a few seconds, and then presses his hand to the glass so it lines up with mine. I pretend I can feel the warmth of it through the window. He leans his forehead against the door and squeezes his eyes shut. I take my hand down and turn away before he can open his eyes. I feel pain in my chest, worse than when I got shot in the shoulder. I clutch the front of my shirt, blink away tears, and rejoin Peter in the main hallway. Thank you, I say quietly. I meant to say it louder. Whatever. Peter scowls again. Let's just go. I hear rumbling somewhere ahead of us, the sound of a crowd. The next hallway is packed with dauntless traitors, tall and short, young and old, armed and unarmed. They all wear the blue armband of betrayal. Hey! Peter shouts. Clear path! The dauntless traitors closest to us hear him and press against the walls to make way for us. The other dauntless traitors follow suit soon after, and everyone is quiet. Peter steps back to let me go ahead of him. I know the way from here. I don't know where the pounding starts, but someone drums their fists against the wall, and someone else joins in and I walk down the aisle between solemn but raucous dauntless traitors, their hands in motion at their sides. The pounding is so fast my heart races to keep up with it. Some of the dauntless traitors incline their heads to me. I'm not sure why. It doesn't matter. I reach the end of the hallway and open the door to my execution chamber. I open it. Dauntless traitors crowded the hallway. The erudite crowd the execution room. But there, they have made a path for me already. Silently, they study me as I walk to the metal table in the center of the room. Janine stands a few steps away. The scratches on her face show through hastily applied makeup. She doesn't look at me. Four cameras dangle from the ceiling, one at each corner of the table. I sit down first, wipe my hands off on my pants, and then lie down. The table is cold, frigid, seeping into my skin, into my bones. Appropriate, perhaps, because that is what will happen to my body when all the life leaves it. It will become cold and heavy, heavier than I've ever been. As for the rest of me, I am not sure. Some people believe that I will go nowhere, and maybe they're right, but maybe they're not. Such speculations are no longer useful to me anyway. Peter slips an electrode beneath the collar of my shirt, and presses it to my chest, right over my heart. He then attaches a wire to the electrode and switches on the heart monitor. I hear my heartbeat, fast and strong. Soon, where that steady rhythm was, there will be nothing. And then rising from within me is a single thought. I don't want to die. All those times Tobias scolded me for risking my life, I never took him seriously. I believed that I wanted to be with my parents and for all of this to be over. I was sure I wanted to emulate their self-sacrifice. But no. No, no. Burning and boiling inside me is the desire to live. I don't want to die. I don't want to die. I don't want to. Janine steps forward with a syringe full of purple serum. Her glasses reflect the fluorescent light above us, so I can barely see her eyes. Every part of my body chants it in unison. Live, live, live. I thought that in order to give my life in exchange for Will's, in exchange for my parents, that I needed to die. But I was wrong. I need to live my life in the light of their deaths. I need to live. Janine holds my head steady with one hand and inserts the needle into my neck with the other. I'm not done, I shout in my head and nod at Janine. I am not done here. She presses the plunger down. Peter leans forward and looks into my eyes. The serum will go into effect in 1 minute, he says. Be brave, Triss. The words startle me, because that is exactly what Tobias said when he put me under my first simulation. My heart begins to race. Why would Peter tell me to be brave? Why would he offer any kind words at all? All the muscles in my body relax at once. A heavy liquid feeling fills my limbs. If this is death, it isn't so bad. My eyes stay open, but my head drops to the side. I try to close my eyes, but I can't. I can't move. Then the heart monitor stops beeping. Chapter 36. But I'm still breathing. Not deeply. Not enough to satisfy. But breathing. Peter pushes my eyelids over my eyes. Does he know I'm not dead? Does Janine? Can she see me breathing?
Take the body to the lab, Janine says. The autopsy is scheduled for this afternoon.
All right, Peter replies.
Peter pushes the table forward. I hear mutters all around me as we pass the group of erudite bystanders. My hand falls off the edge of the table as we turn a corner and smacks into the wall. I feel a prickle of pain in my fingertips, but I can't move my hand, as hard as I try. This time, when we go down the hallway of dauntless traitors, it is silent. Peter walks slowly at first, then turns another corner and picks up the pace. He almost sprints down the next corridor and stops abruptly. Where am I? I can't be in the lab already. Why did he stop? Peter's arms slide under my knees and shoulders and he lifts me. My head falls against his shoulder.
For someone so small, you're heavy, stiff, he mutters.
He knows I'm awake. He knows. I hear a series of beeps and a slide, a locked door opening.
What do—
Tobias's voice. Tobias!
Oh my God! Oh!
Spare me the blubbering, okay? Peter says. She's not dead. She's just paralyzed. It'll only last for about a minute. Now get ready to run.
I don't understand. How does Peter know?
Let me carry her, Tobias says.
No! You're better shot than I am. Take my gun. I'll carry her.
I hear the gun slide out of its holster. Tobias brushes a hand over my forehead.
They both start running.
At first, all I hear is the pounding of their feet, and my head snaps back painfully. I feel tingling in my hands and feet. Peter shouts, "Left!" at Tobias, then a shout from down the hallway.
Hey! What?
A bang. And nothing. More running.
Peter shouts, "Right!"
I hear another bang, and another.
Whoa!
He mumbles.
Wait! Stop here!
Tingling down my spine, I open my eyes as Peter opens another door. He charges through it, and just before I smack my head against the doorframe,
I stick my arm out and stop us.
Careful!
I say, my voice strained. My throat still feels as tight as it did when he first injected me, and I found it difficult to breathe. Peter turns sideways to bring me through the door, then nudges it shut with his heel and drops me on the floor. The room is almost empty, except for a row of empty trash cans along one wall and a square metal door large enough for one of the cans to fit through it along the other wall.
Triss, Tobias says, crouching next to me. His face is pale, almost yellow.
There is too much I want to say. The first thing that comes out is, Beatrice.
He laughs weakly. Beatrice, he amends, and touches his lips to mine.
I curl my fingers into his shirt.
Unless you want me to throw up all over you guys, you might want to save it for later.
Where are we? I ask.
This is the trash incinerator, says Peter, slapping the square door. I turned it off. It'll take us to the alley, and then your aim had better be perfect for if you want to get out of the erudite sector alive.
Don't concern yourself with my aim, Tobias retorts. He, like me, is barefoot. Peter opens the door to the incinerator.
Trish, you first.
The trash chute is about 3 feet wide and 4 feet high. I slide one leg down the chute, and with Tobias's help swing the other leg in. My stomach drops as I slide down a short metal tube. Then a series of rollers pound against my back as I slip over them. I smell fire and ash, but I am not burned. Then I drop, and my arm smacks into a metal wall, making me groan. I land on a cement floor hard, and pain from the impact prickles up my shins.
Ow!
I limp away from the opening and shout, "Go ahead!" My legs have recovered by the time Peter lands, on his side instead of his feet. He groans and drags himself away from the opening to recover. I look around. We are inside the incinerator, which would be completely dark if not for the lines of light glowing in the shape of a small door on the other side. The floor is solid metal in some places, and metal grating in others. Everything smells like rotten garbage and fire.
Don't say I never took you anywhere nice, Peter says.
Wouldn't dream of it, I say. Tobias drops to the floor, landing first on his feet, and then tilting forward to his knees, wincing. I pull him to his feet and then draw close to his side. All the smells and sights and feelings of the world feel magnified. I was almost dead, but instead, I am alive. Because of Peter. Of all people. Peter walks across the grate and opens the small door. Light streams into the incinerator. Tobias walks with me away from the fire smell, away from the metal furnace, into the cement-walled room that contains it.
Got your gun? Peter says to Tobias.
No,
says Tobias. I figured I would shoot the bullets out of my nostrils, so I left it upstairs.
Oh, shut up!
Peter holds his gun in front of him and leaves the incinerator room. A dank hallway with exposed pipes in the ceiling greets us. But it's only 10 feet long. The sign next to the door at the end says, Exit. I am alive, and I am leaving. The stretch of land between Dauntless Headquarters and Erudite Headquarters does not look the same in reverse. I suppose everything is bound to look different when you aren't on your way to die. When we reach the end of the alley, Tobias presses his shoulder to one wall and leans forward just enough to see around the corner. His face blank, he puts one arm around the corner, steadying it with the building wall, and fires twice. I shove my fingers in my ears and try not to pay attention to the gunshots and what they make me remember.
Hurry, Tobias says.
We sprint, Peter first, me second, and Tobias last down Wabash Avenue. I look over my shoulder to see what Tobias shot at and see two men on the ground behind Erudite Headquarters. One isn't moving, and the other is clutching his arm and running toward the door. They will send others after us. My head feels muddled, probably from exhaustion, but the adrenaline keeps me running.
Take the least logical route, shouts Tobias.
What? Peter says.
The least logical route, Tobias says, so they won't find us.
Peter swerves to the left, down another alley. This one full of cardboard boxes that contain frayed blankets and stained pillows. Old factionless dwellings, I assume.
He jumps over a box that I go crashing through, kicking it behind me. At the end of the alley, he turns left toward the marsh. We are back on Michigan Avenue, in plain sight of Erudite headquarters, if anyone cares to glance down the street.
Bad idea! I shout.
Peter takes the next right. At least all the streets here are clear. No fallen street signs to dodge or holes to jump over. My lungs burn like I inhaled poison. My legs, which ached at first, are now numb, which is better. Somewhere far away, I hear shouts. Then it occurs to me, the least logical thing to do is stop running. I grab Peter's sleeve and drag him toward the nearest building. It is 6 stories high, with wide windows arranged into a grid divided by pillars of brick. The first door is locked, but Tobias fires at the window next to it until it breaks and unlocks the door from the inside. The building is completely empty, not a single chair or table, and there are too many windows. We walk toward the emergency stairwell, and I crawl beneath the first flight so that we are hidden by the staircase. Tobias sits next to me, and Peter across from us both, his knees drawn to his chest. I try to catch my breath and calm myself down, but it isn't easy. I was dead. I was dead. And then I wasn't. And why? Because of Peter? Peter? I stare at him. He still looks so innocent, despite all that he has done to prove that he is not. His hair lies smooth against his head, shiny and dark, like we didn't just run for a mile at full speed. His round eyes scan the stairwell and then rest on my face.
What? He says. Why are you looking at me like that?
How did you do it? I say.
It wasn't that hard, he says. I dyed some water purple and switched it out with the death serum. Replaced the wire that was supposed to read your heartbeat with a dead one. The bit with the heart monitor was harder. I had to get some erudite help with a remote and stuff. You wouldn't understand it if I explained it to you.
Why did you do it? I say. You want me dead. You were willing to do it yourself. What changed? He presses his lips together and doesn't look away, not for a long time. Then he opens his mouth, hesitates, and finally says, I can't be in anyone's debt, okay? The idea that I owed you something made me sick. I would wake up in the middle of the night feeling like I was going to vomit. Indebted to a stiff? It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And I couldn't have it. What are you talking about? You owed me something. He rolls his eyes. The Amity compound. Someone shot me. The bullet was at head level. It would have hit me right between the eyes. And you shoved me out of the way. We were even before that. I almost killed you during initiation. You almost killed me during the attack simulation. We're square, right? But after that... You're insane, says Tobias. That's not the way the world works, with everyone keeping score.
It's not?
Peter raises his eyebrows.
I don't know what world you live in, but mine?
People only do things for you for one of two reasons. The first is if they want something in return, and the second is if they feel like they owe you something. Those aren't the only reasons people do things for you, I say. Sometimes they do them because they love you. Well, maybe not you, but... Peter snorts. That's exactly the kind of garbage I expect from a delusional stiff to say.
I guess we just have to make sure you owe us, says Tobias. Or you'll go running to whoever offers you the best deal.
Yeah, Peter says. That's pretty much how it is. I shake my head. I can't imagine living the way he does, always keeping track of who gave me what and what I should give them in return, incapable of love or loyalty or forgiveness. A one-eyed man with a knife in hand looking for someone else's eye to poke out. That isn't life. It's some paler version of life. I wonder where he learned it from.
So when can we get out of here, you think? Peter says.
Couple hours, says Tobias. We should go to the abnegation sector. That's where the factionless and the dauntless who aren't wired for simulations will be by now.
Fantastic, says Peter.
Tobias puts his arm around me. I press my cheek into his shoulder and close my eyes so I don't have to look at Peter. I know there is a lot to say, though I'm not sure exactly what it is, but we can't say it here, or now.
As we walk the streets I once called home, conversations sputter and die, and eyes cling to my face and body. As far as they knew, and I'm sure they knew, because Janine knows how to spread news, I died less than 6 hours ago. I notice that some of the faction lists I pass are marked with patches of blue dye. They are simulation ready. Now that we're here and safe, I realize that there are cuts all over the bottoms of my feet from running over rough pavement and bits of glass from broken windows. Every step stings. I focus on that instead of all the stairs.
Triss?
Someone calls out ahead of us. I lift my head and see Uriah and Christina on the sidewalk, comparing revolvers. Uriah drops his gun in the grass and sprints toward me. Christina follows him but at a slower pace. Uriah reaches for me, but Tobias sets a hand on his shoulder to stop him. I feel a surge of gratitude. I don't think I can handle Uriah's embrace, or his questions, or his surprise right now.
She's been through a lot, Tobias says. She just needs to sleep. She'll be down the street number 37. Come visit tomorrow.
Uriah frowns at me. The Dauntless don't usually understand restraint, and Uriah has only ever known the Dauntless. But he must respect Tobias's assessment of me, because he nods and says, "Okay, tomorrow." Christina reaches out as I pass her and squeezes my shoulder lightly. I try to stand up straighter, but my muscles feel like a cage, holding my shoulders hunched. The eyes follow me down the street, pinching the back of my neck. I am relieved when Tobias leads us up the front walk of the gray house that belonged to Marcus Eaton. I don't know by what strength Tobias marches through the doorway. For him, this house must contain echoes of screaming parents and belt snaps and hours spent in small dark closets. Yet he doesn't look troubled as he leads Peter and me into the kitchen. If anything, he stands taller. But maybe that is Tobias. When he's supposed to be weak, he's strong. Tori, Harrison, and Evelyn stand in the kitchen. The sight overwhelms me. I lean my shoulder into the wall and squeeze my eyes shut. The outline of the execution table is printed on my eyelids. I open my eyes. I try to breathe. They are talking, but I can't hear what they're saying. Why is Evelyn here, in Marcus's house? Where's Marcus? Evelyn puts one arm around Tobias and touches his face with the other, pressing her cheek to his. She says something to him. He smiles at her when he pulls away. Mother and son reconciled. I am not sure it's wise. Tobias turns me around, and keeping one hand on my arm and one on my waist, to avoid my shoulder wound, presses me toward the staircase. We climb the steps together. Upstairs are his parents' old bedroom and his old bedroom, with a bathroom between them, and that's it. He takes me into his bedroom, and I stand for a moment, looking around the room where he spent most of his life. He keeps his hand on my arm. He has been touching me in some way since we left the stairwell of that building, like he thinks I might break apart if he doesn't hold me together.
Marcus didn't go into this room after I left, I'm pretty sure, says Tobias, because nothing was moved when I came back here.
Members of Abnegation don't own many decorations, since they are viewed as self-indulgent, but what few things we were allowed, he has. A stack of school papers, a small bookshelf, and strangely, a sculpture made of blue glass on his dresser.
My mother smuggled that to me when I was young, told me to hide it, he says. The day of the ceremony, I put it on my dresser before I left, so he would see it. A small act of defiance.
I nod. It is strange to be in a place that carries one single memory so completely. This room is 16-year-old Tobias, about to choose Dauntless to escape his father.
Let's take care of your feet, he says.
But he doesn't move, just shifts his fingers to the inside of my elbow.
Okay, I say.
We walk into the adjoined bathroom, and I sit on the edge of the tub. He sits next to me, a hand on my knee as he turns on the faucet and plugs the drain. Water spills into the tub, covering my toenails. My blood turns the water pink. He crouches in the tub and puts my foot in his lap, dabbing at the deeper cuts with a washcloth.
I don't feel it. Even when he smears soap lather over them, I don't feel anything. The bathwater turns gray. I pick up the bar of soap and turn it in my hands until my skin is coated with white lather. I reach for him and run my fingers over his hands, careful to get the lines in his palms and the spaces between his fingers. It feels good to do something, to clean something, to have my hands on him again. We get water all over the bathroom floor as we both splash it on ourselves to get the soap off. The water makes me cold, but I shiver and I don't care. He gets a towel and starts to dry my hands. I sound like I am being strangled. My family is all dead, or traitors. How can I? I am not making any sense. The sobs take over my body, my mind, everything. He gathers me to him, and bathwater soaks my legs. His hold is tight. I listen to his heartbeat, and after a while, find a way to let the rhythm calm me. "I'll be your family now," he says. "I love you," I say. I said that once, before I went to Erudite headquarters, but he was asleep then. I don't know why I didn't say it when he could hear it. Maybe I was afraid to trust him with something so personal as my devotion, or afraid that I did not know what it was to love someone. But now I think the scary thing was not saying it before it was almost too late. Not saying it before it was almost too late for me. I am his, and he is mine, and it has been that way all along. He stares at me. I wait with my hands clutching his arms for stability as he considers his response. He frowns at me. "Say it again." "Tobias," I say, "I love you." His skin is slippery with water, and he smells like sweat, and my shirt sticks to his arms when he slides them around me. He presses his face to my neck and kisses me right above the collarbone, kisses my cheek, kisses my lips. "I love you too," he says. Chapter 37. He lies next to me as I fall asleep. I expect to have nightmares, but I must be too tired, because my mind stays empty. When I open my eyes next, he's gone, but there's a stack of clothes on the bed beside me. I get up and walk into the bathroom, and I feel raw, like my skin was scraped clean, and every breath of air stings it a little, but stable. I don't turn on the lights in the bathroom, because I know they will be pale and bright, just like the lights in the Erudite compound. I shower in the dark, barely able to tell soap from conditioner, and tell myself that I will emerge new and strong, that the water will heal me. Before I leave the bathroom, I pinch my cheeks hard to bring blood to the surface of my skin. It's stupid, but I don't want to look weak and exhausted in front of everyone. When I walk back into Tobias's room, Uriah is sprawled across the bed face down. Christina is holding the blue sculpture above Tobias's desk, examining it, and Lynn is poised above Uriah with a pillow, a wicked grin creeping across her face. Lynn smacks Uriah hard in the back of the head. Christina says, "Hey, Tris," and Uriah cries, "Ow! How on earth do you make a pillow hurt, Lynn?" "My exceptional strength," she says. "Did you get smacked, Tris? One of your cheeks is bright red." I must not have pinched the other one hard enough.
"No, it's just my morning glow."
I try the joke out on my tongue like it's a new language. Christina laughs, maybe a little harder than my comment warrants, but I appreciate the effort. Uriah bounces on the bed a few times when he moves to the edge. "So, the thing we're not talking about," he says. He gestures to me. "You almost died, a sadistic pansy cake saved you, and now we're all waging some serious war with the factionless as allies."
"Pansy cake?" says Christina.
"Dauntless slang," Lynn smirks. "Supposed to be a huge insult, only no one uses it anymore."
"Because it's so offensive," says Uriah, nodding.
"No, because it's so stupid no dauntless with any sense would speak it, let alone think it.
Pansy cake? What are you, 12?
"And a half," he says. I get the feeling their banter is for my benefit, so that I don't have to say anything. I can just laugh. And I do. Enough to warm the stone that is formed in my stomach.
There's food downstairs, says Christina. Tobias made scrambled eggs, which, as it turns out, is a disgusting food.
Hey, I say, I like scrambled eggs.
Must be a stiff breakfast then.
She grabs my arm.
Come on.
Together we go down the stairs, our footsteps thundering as they never would have been allowed to in my parents' house. My father used to scold me for running down the stairs.
Do not call attention to yourself, he said. It is not courteous to the people around you.
I hear voices in the living room, a chorus of them, in fact, joined by occasional bursts of laughter and a faint melody plucked on an instrument, a banjo or a guitar. It is not what I expect in an abnegation house, where everything is always quiet, no matter how many people are gathered within. The voices and the laughter and the music breathe life into the sullen walls. I feel even warmer. I stand in the doorway to the living room. Five people are crowded onto the three-person couch, playing a card game I recognize from Candor headquarters. A man sits in the armchair with a woman balanced on his lap, and someone else perches on the arm, a can of soup in hand. Tobias sits on the floor, his back against the coffee table. Every part of his posture suggests ease. One leg bent, the other straight, an arm slung across his knee, his head tilted to listen. I have never seen him look so comfortable without a gun. I didn't think it was possible. I get the same sinking feeling in my stomach that I always get when I know I've been lied to. But I don't know who it was that lied to me this time, or about what exactly. But this is not what I was taught to expect of factionlessness. I was taught that it was worse than death. I stand there for just a few seconds before people realize that I'm there. Their conversation peters out. I wipe my palms off on the hem of my shirt. Too many eyes, and too much silence. Evelyn clears her throat.
Everyone, this is Triss Pryor. I believe you may have heard a lot about her yesterday.
And Christina, Uriah, and Lynn, supplies Tobias. I'm grateful for his attempt to divert everyone's attention from me, but it doesn't work. I stand glued to the doorframe for a few seconds, and then one of the factionless men, older, his wrinkled skin patterned with tattoos, speaks up.
Aren't you supposed to be dead?
Some of the others laugh, and I try a smile. It emerges crooked and small.
Supposed to be, I say.
We don't like to give Janine Matthews what she wants, though, Tobias says. He gets up and hands me a can of peas. But it isn't full of peas. It's full of scrambled eggs. The aluminum warms my fingers. He sits so I sit next to him and scoop some of the eggs into my mouth. I am not hungry, but I know I need to eat, so I chew and swallow anyway. I am familiar with the way the factionless eat, so I pass the eggs to Christina and take a can of peaches from Tobias.
Why is everyone camped out in Marcus's house? I ask him.
Evelyn kicked him out. Said it was her house, too, and he'd gotten to use it for years, and it was her turn.
Tobias grins.
It caused a huge blow-up on the front lawn. But eventually Evelyn won.
I glance at Tobias's mother. She is in the far corner of the room, talking to Peter and eating more eggs from another can. My stomach turns. Tobias talks about her almost reverently. But I still remember what she said to me about my transience in Tobias's life. There's bread somewhere. He picks up a basket from the coffee table and hands it to me. Take two pieces. You need it. As I chew on the bread crust, I look at Peter and Evelyn again.
I think she's trying to recruit him, Tobias says. She has a way of making the factionless life sound extraordinarily appealing.
Anything to get him out of Dauntless. I don't care if he saved my life. I still don't like him.
Hopefully we won't have to worry about faction distinctions anymore by the time this is over.
It'll be nice, I think. I don't say anything. I don't feel like picking a fight with him here. Or reminding him that it won't be so easy to persuade Dauntless and Candor to join the factionless in their crusade against the faction system. It may take another war. The front door opens, and Edward enters. Today he wears a patch with a blue eye painted on it, complete with a half-lowered eyelid. The effect of the overlarge eye against his otherwise handsome face
is both grotesque and amusing.
Eddie!
Someone calls out in greeting. But Edward's good eye has already fallen on Peter. He starts across the room, nearly kicking a can of food out of someone's hand. Peter presses into the shadow of the doorframe like he is trying to disappear into it. Edward stops inches from Peter's feet, and then jerks toward him like he is about to throw a punch. Peter jolts back so hard he slams his head into the wall. Edward grins, and all around us, the factionless laugh.
"Not so brave in broad daylight," Edward says, and then to Evelyn, "Make sure you don't give him any utensils. Never know what he might do with them."
As he speaks, he plucks the fork from Peter's hand.
"Give that back," says Peter.
Edward slams his free hand into Peter's throat and presses the tines of the fork between his fingers, right against Peter's Adam's apple. Peter stiffens, blood rushing into his face.
"Keep your mouth shut around me," he says, his voice low, "or I will do this again, only next time, I'll shove it right through your esophagus."
"That's enough," Evelyn says. Edward drops the fork and releases Peter. Then he walks across the room and sits next to the person who called him Eddie a moment before.
"I don't know if you know this," Tobias says, "but Edward is a little unstable."
"I'm getting that," I say.
"That Drew guy who helped Peter perform that butter knife maneuver," Tobias says. "Apparently when he got kicked out of Dauntless, he tried to join the same group of factionless Edward was a part of. Notice that you haven't seen Drew anywhere?"
"Did Edward kill him?" I say.
"Nearly," Tobias says. "Evidently that's why that other transfer, Myra, I think her name was, left Edward. Too gentle to bear it."
I feel hollow at the thought of Drew, almost dead at the hands of Edward. Drew attacked me, too.
"I don't want to talk about this," I say.
"Okay," Tobias says. He touches my shoulder. "Is it hard for you to be in an abnegation house again? I meant to ask before. We can go somewhere else if it is." I finish my second piece of bread. All abnegation houses are the same. So this living room is exactly the same as my own. And it does bring back memories. If I look at it carefully. Light glowing through the blinds every morning. Enough for my father to read by. The click of my mother's knitting needles every evening. But I don't feel like I'm choking. It's a start.
"Yes," I say.
"But not as hard as you might think."
He raises an eyebrow.
"Really? The simulation's in erudite headquarters. Help me somehow. To hold on, maybe?" I frown. "Or maybe not. Maybe they help me to stop holding on so tightly." "That sounds right. Someday I'll tell you about it." My voice sounds far away. He touches my cheek, and even though we're in a room full of people, crowded by laughter and conversation, slowly kisses me.
"Whoa there, Tobias," says the man to my left. "Weren't you raised a stiff? I thought the most you people did was graze hands or something."
"Then how do you explain all the abnegation children?" Tobias raises his eyebrows.
"They're brought into being by sheer force of will," the woman on the arm of the chair interjects. "Didn't you know that, Tobias?"
"No, I wasn't aware," he grins.
"My apologies." They all laugh. We all laugh. And it occurs to me that I might be meeting Tobias's true faction. They are not characterized by a particular virtue. They claim all colors, all activities, all virtues, and all flaws as their own. I don't know what binds them together. The only common ground they have, as far as I know, is failure. Whatever it is, it seems to be enough. I feel as I look at him that I am finally seeing him as he is, instead of how he is in relation to me. So how well do I really know him, if I have not seen this before? The sun is beginning to set. The abnegation sector is far from quiet. The dauntless and factionless wander the streets, some with bottles in their hands, some with guns in their other hands. Ahead of me, Zeke pushes Shauna in her wheelchair past the house of Alice Brewster, former abnegation leader. They don't see me.
Do it again, she says.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay.